This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known people about their lives, their careers, and those difficult moments on the way. My name's Giles Paley Phillips, and I'm here with Jim Daly.
Hello to you. That was weird.
Yeah.
Halfway through that, I realised that wasn't really going how I planned. Anyway, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, actually. I've had a haircut, although by the time
another one.
My hair will be long again. No, did I have one last week?
You did, yeah.
Oh, never mind. Anyway, I'm enjoying my haircut. It's sunny. I'm wearing shorts.
Are you?
Summer is here. Yeah, do you want to see them? They're great, actually.
Are they sports?
They're short shorts.
Sort
of, they're like jogger style shorts. Not joggers, but you wear like...
cotton.
Cotton shorts. They're from a company called... it sounds like I'm doing advertising. UB, they're Australian, and they all have little. This one's got lemons on. They've got little. They're really comfy.
Nice.
They're great. So I would recommend them big time. They're not sponsoring the pod, but I just I'm a big fan.
But they can if they want. They're called UB.
I've already bought all their stuff though, so there's no point.
Okay, UB.
EUBI, I think is
cool.
Yeah, they're great.
I haven't gone shorts yet, but I noticed we're both in green. Which is not good for listeners.
This t-shirt is terrible start. This is an awful start. This is sort of yellowy green. Yeah, this is a t-shirt my mum got me for Christmas ages ago. You know how like you have some t-shirts.
Your mum bought you some clothes, and you're actually wearing them.
Yeah, on a podcast that no one can see.
Yeah. It's actually a very nice t-shirt.
It's really nice. I think it's Jack and Jones. Or I don't know. Why am I doing so much branding? I don't know about you. I have a lot of t-shirts in my wardrobe. Most of them low quality, cheap.
Yeah.
Band t-shirts, whatever. Now and then you have a few that fit nicely. This is just one of the ones that feels good to wear. It makes me want to buy slightly more expensive t-shirts that actually fit better.
I always say this. You get like something nice and it's a bit more expensive and you think, I'm never going to buy one of those cheap H&M t-shirts again. And then you end up buying those because they do nice colours and things, and you can't ever justify spending £30 on a t-shirt.
But actually, it is because
they do have better quality. Actually, H&M quality t-shirts are quite good.
We are going heavy on the branding on this episode. Wow.
Sorry, there are obviously lots more nicer places to buy t-shirts from, but
do you know where you can get really nice t-shirts from? With Blank branding on.
Oh, you can. What? This is, oh my God, you would think that this was all worked out beforehand.
I wasn't planned at all, but I just suddenly thought, oh, let's get that in. We have a merch store. Let's mention that merch store, podcastmerch.co.uk/blank. Nice quality tees.
Yeah.
Blank expressions and logos and whatever on there.
We've just lost 1,000 subscribers and we're going to get loads of one-star reviews on Apple saying terrible. I used to love the pod before they did ads every week.
They're not ads because we're not getting paid for any of this. I'm just talking about the clothes that I'm wearing that I happen to like. I wish we were.
I used to love Blank Pod until they started doing advertising on every
sellouts.
Episode.
Yeah. I mean, they're sellouts. Getting no money, but they're still sellouts.
Yeah, fucking sellouts, wankers.
Oh, dear. Should we move away from our branding intro then?
Yeah, I think we should.
Talk about our guest this week.
Amazing guest. I mean, we are... So the game of League of Gentlemen Bingo is going very, yeah, very well. We've got three corners now. And I know for a fact that we're going to get a full house.
We are going to get a full house
in the next few months. So I'm very excited because it is the brilliant Steve Pemberton.
It is. Yeah. What a man. Really nice guy. We should say this. We had some slight internet issues, I would say, with this one. I mean, Giles, you haven't done the edit yet, so we'll see how that comes out. Yeah. I'm sure you're going to work your magic and it's going to sound fantastic. But yeah, Steve,
Yeah, he was. And as you know, Jim, we don't like to edit our episodes, but there will be a little bit of trickery and jiggery-pokery with this one.
Just, well, yeah, there was one bit where he dropped out completely. Yeah. And this was want to hear us then talking about our days.
Yeah.
While we were waiting for Steve to log back on again.
Yeah, it was just one of those things. Bless him, Steve. He'd set up at home, I think, to do the pod with us and got his headphones sorted and everything. And then both his neighbours either side were doing renovations and another was doing gardening. And so he had this sort of surround sound of like buzzing and soaring and all sorts of things. So he headed down to where he writes the brilliant Inside Number 9, which we talk about quite a lot on the podcast. Which he writes with Reece Shearsmith, and they have a room that they rent, and he headed down there, but obviously the Wi-Fi was a little bit tricky, but it didn't take away from what was a wonderful conversation. And we hear all about his brilliant work, and you know, we started off the conversation talking about Bretton Hall, which we talked to Reece and Mark about. Which is,
and we will do with Jeremy, I'm guessing. Yeah. At some point.
Well, I don't think they met Jeremy at Bretton Hall, funny enough. I think I need to do a little bit more research, but I think they met him after that. But yeah, certainly they.
So no more Bretton Hall chat. Oh,
no,
shame.
I know, it's a shame. But I mean, obviously you know about Bretton Hall because your wife Miranda went there, and it's just now has got a reputation for being this sort of strange.
But what an alumni though as well. I mean, Bretton Hall's obviously not a college anymore, but like I'm sure they're very proud of them. Of the guys going on to form, you know, to do what they do, and just, yeah, fantastic. I mean, Steve sort of goes into some of their writing processes and talking about the live shows. And but when you think about what they've achieved with that and, you know, the status it's got and the love it's got from the fans, like, I think it's just amazing to have created something like that. But it's interesting hearing him talking about sort of working as part of a group. Mm. You know, they've got this really strong connection, the guys, and the strong sort of synergy, and it's interesting hearing how that kind of comes to the fore as well. So it was a really interesting chat with Steve. I just think it shows the measure of the sort of person he is that he went to his office because he thought it'd be too noisy, and then even when the internet was down, was persisting to make it work for us. So I thought that was really showed sort of what a nice guy he was. He was trying to make it work as much as possible for this interview, and in the end we got a fantastic chat with him.
Yeah, well, resilience came up a lot on the pod, didn't it?
Yeah,
so I think that was part of it. But yeah, huge thanks. It's taken a while to get this one sorted, with schedules and things. So, you know, really, really pleased. He was one of those people I was desperate to want to talk to. And what's really great is that it's unique in a way that we've been able to have, you know, these sort of three members separately talking about their experiences of working together and on separate projects as well. And actually you can see why they're friends. You can see why they have this connection, because they're so like-minded in their outlooks. Yeah. And actually, you know, I know we touched upon it in the podcast, but there's certain things that came up in the episodes with Reece and Mark that very much come up in this one as well. So I know it's really lovely, and it's a real privilege to be able to talk to. I mean, some of the greatest comedy in recent years has been created by these guys. Well, not just comedy, actually just greatest material. TV shows that we've seen on British television. So, yeah, really a real privilege to spend time with them.
It really was. It really, really was. So I think we should crack on. Before we do that, we've got some tweets, haven't we?
We've got some lovely tweets. I've got one here from Chloe Banks, and her handle is Chloe Tells Tales. Her message is, if you like listening to interesting and lovely people chat, then do check out Blank Pod. Some great guests. I really enjoyed listening to Ian Rankin very much. It's very chilled, conversational sort of podcast to go about your day with. Well, that's very nice. Thank you, Chloe. What and that a was lovely. A lovely podcast. That was a great episode with Ian.
Oh, what a legend. That was a really great episode. And what a lovely review. Thank you so much. It's nice that people... We're trying to put out a chilled, relaxed, you know, podcast. It's nice that people hear it like that.
Yeah.
You don't always know. In fact, actually, this comes up with Steve talking about you work on these things. You put it out there. You don't know how the audience are going to kind of react to it. It's really nice that people get what we're doing. Like it's lovely, really. And we are clearly, like Steve and his working with the guys, we're connecting with the right people with this podcast as well. So it's so nice to get a review like that. I mean, here is a review on Twitter from someone called Patterson Joseph. Oh. I feel like we had him on the podcast recently.
I think he was on last week.
Yeah. And he's added Nick Offerman, someone else we had on the podcast recently, saying I've just
the previous
myself
week,
to
in fact.
Yeah, exactly. This well, timing is fantastic.
Well, I'll let you into a little secret. Patterson, when we arranged the podcast, obviously we arranged it quite a long time ago, but he did jokingly message me the week we were supposed to be recording with him, saying, I'm not following Nick Offerman. And I said, well, look, I know it's going to be a great episode with you, and I think it's absolutely you're in the same league as Nick Offerman in my head. So it's nice that they've he's messaged about it as well.
Yeah, that's lovely. He said, I've just treated myself to Blank Pod with Mr. Offerman. I love him even more now. Proper lovely fella. Wise and funny and informative about the way we could live better. A few new authors to enjoy too. Yeah, I mean, there are so many takeaways from that Nick Offerman episode. And I'm really glad that Patterson enjoyed it as much as we did, because we were in the room or in the Zoom, and we were in awe of Nick big time. So it was lovely. And then Nick replied to the tweet. This is great. This is just, I mean, when we started this podcast, we just thought we'd chat to nice people. We're getting some lovely Twitter content as a result. Anyway, Nick said, listen, you peach. Giles did some very heavy editing on this podcast episode to render me remotely palatable. But thanks for putting up with it anyway. Giles, your editing skills are now getting called out and mentioned on Twitter.
Well, I didn't edit that one at all. So that's great. We left everything in. So
even when I dropped out.
Even when you dropped out, we particularly made a big thing out of that one.
Oh, I should mention, actually, we've got a guy that comes around and does fix stuff in our house called Matt Evans. He's really lovely, big fan of the pod. And he was around the other day doing stuff in the garden. And he said that he really enjoyed the Nick Offerman pod. And the best bit was when I dropped out. He thought that was the funniest bit. But he told me I need to get better internet. So I am going to try and sort my internet out to do that. Apt this week, actually, given Steve's internet issues as well. And then Patterson replied to Nick's tweet. We could just do an episode where we just pull up his tweet.
Yeah.
I was kind of hypnotized, to be honest. Maybe I'll look back on this as the moment I could have pulled away from the offer cult. And he's put a very funny gif as well. I mean, just we are so lucky doing this pod and chatting to these guys and being part of their lives and they're being part of our lives. So, feeling love big time.
Yeah, well, both wonderful guests and wonderful human beings, I would say, actually, as well. Very, very... responsive and lovely and thoughtful and inspiring guys. So thank you so much for the lovely messages, and it's lovely to be included in those. So thank you
big time. Well, I think we should crack on with this week's episode. It's the one and only, it's the third in our League of Gentlemen quadruple. We're getting there. It's the one and only Steve Pemberton on the Blank Podcast.
So anyway, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it, Steve. We are slowly getting through our League of Gentlemen bingo. We've had Mark and Reese on, and Jeremy's coming on next month as well. So that would be the four corners of the league bingo. But
absolutely,
I wondered if I could start by talking about Bretton Hall, because and if you indulge me, I've got some quotes here from previous podcasts with Mark and Reese of their thoughts about Bretton Hall.
Okay.
Mark said, we have very fond, slightly hysteria-tinged memories. To be absolutely frank, it was a pretty terrible course. And Reece said, you were warned about cabin fever, before you were thinking of going there. And it's a bit Overlook Hotel, which is obviously the hotel in The Shining.
Yes.
Are they kind of the sort of memories, overriding memories for you of Bretton Hall?
Yeah, I think that's a fair description. I mean, obviously, as I think you get older, things take on, you see things with rose-tinted spectacles and you get nostalgic for stuff which at the time you had very little truck with. So in terms of the course, it was a degree course. I'm sure that, all three of us were, interested in becoming actors, which not everybody is that does a degree course, but to please parents and to make it not seem like a colossal waste of money, I didn't even consider the drama schools, the London drama schools. So that's why I ended up there. And it is a very rural, cut-off place. When you arrive at the bus, there's a big hill, which is nice going down, but it's very hard to leave. We called it the Bretton Magnet, where to leave and walk up to that bus, knowing that the last bus back from Wakefield, the nearest town, actually left at 9:30. So you weren't going to have much of an evening anyway. So it did have this pull that kind of kept you there. And it became very cabin fevery, like Reese said. But look, we had a 30-year anniversary get together. We got most of the people on our course back together. Tracked them down, and we had a whale of a time, and I have nothing but fond memories now, though at the time I was thinking, why am I here? But it served us well. If any of us hadn't gone there and met the others, I seriously doubt we would have. You often think about those little moments, the paths not taken, what would have happened if, and I'm pretty sure that all of us with the same talent that we have and the same people that we are, you don't know what would have happened if you'd gone another way. So we are very grateful to have met each other there and to have gone there. But we did all kinds of mad stuff. And the teachers there had been there a long time. They were a little bit local shop-esque from the League of Gentlemen. There was a sort of fear of London and the newfangled ways, and they weren't necessarily cutting edge. But look, I'll give you an example. We did a whole thing on the Commedia dell'arte, mask work, Italian mask work. And we've just done a new episode of Inside Number 9, which is drawing on that. So everything that happens to you, you for good or bad, or whether you think it's rubbish at the time, it all comes to bear further down the line.
Well, I was going to say also, there's a solidarity in adversity to a certain extent. Obviously, you found each other in that strange place, and perhaps you could say that maybe it was a brilliant course because you actually forced to kind of come together and work together and have this common ground of this weird place that you're in.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very Royston Vasey-esque, so that we already had a head start when it came to creating that village. But one thing that really stuck in my mind, because we did a lot of improvisation, we did a lot of devising, and you were allowed to create your own work. You weren't just forced to do what the course was. I think a lot of the big posh, what I call the London drama schools, with their own agendas, want you to not do your own work. They want you to, be molded by them into the kind of actor they think you should be. We were writing, devising, and making stuff up from the beginning. And the first play we did when we left, we did a play at the Canal Cafe Theatre, because I set up a theatre company with a friend from Central. And half the cast were from Central School of Speech and Drama, which I can't even say. And the other half were from Bretton Hall. And when it came to doing very technical, like vocal exercises, we were in the dark. We didn't have a clue what we were doing. We didn't know what a diaphragm was. We hadn't been taught any of that stuff, whereas the Central lot were like, me, 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 all the little tongue twisters. But when the director said, okay, try improvising this scene as if you're a character from The Wizard of Oz, we didn't give that a second thought. We went straight into it. And the Central lot was stood there like planks, like, What were you talking about? So what it gave you over those 3 years of being there was this sort of inert creativity and this belief that you could actually create your own work. And that, above anything else that we were taught, has stood us in great stead.
I was going to say, yeah, I guess when it comes to creativity, you can only be sort of quote unquote taught so much. The rest of it has to come from you, and it is in there. So I guess maybe confidence in getting it out, but really you can't quote unquote doing it again, sorry, teach creativity that.
No, you can't. So you can only, I mean, we were lucky that we found each other. Mark and I were in the same year, and we very quickly got together. We would, our eyes would meet across a room. If anything got a bit pretentious, or if people started quoting Monty Python sketches in their full entirety, in a very vocal, show-offy way, that wasn't us. We were very quiet. We would do that, but very quietly between ourselves. And, you know, we kind of... And we thought there was a lot of ridiculous stuff that we were doing. It was a lot of it was rooted in the 60s. Experimental, Lab and Grotowski stuff, which is what people think you do at drama school, you know, pretending to be a tree and, you know, all of that stuff. And you only need somebody else in the room to be able to look at and like, are you thinking what I'm thinking? This is, what are we doing? That's how we bonded and found each other. And then we started to write about the things that we knew. We started to write things about our parents had said, because we both had, we're both from the north, northern working class families. We started to write little plays. We entered a show for the National Student Drama Festival, and that was absolutely the beginnings of the League of Gentlemen, and then Reese joined the year after.
My wife went to Bretton Hall as well, yeah. And everything you're saying about the remoteness of it and the weirdness of it is the same stuff she's told me as well. I mean, I'll be honest, it sounds like a fascinating place. The more I hear about it, I actually kind of want to go and see what. Yeah. I think it's not there anymore, is it?
The college itself had closed down, and I'm really sad about that now. I went back when I was filming Happy Valley because it wasn't that close. It wasn't that far, I mean to say, although it did take ages to get there. And they have this Yorkshire Sculpture Park there now, and it's a really beautiful landscape, and you come across all these Barbara Hepworths and Henry Moores, and Ai Weiwei has got a piece there, and it's a really incredible place. I would go if you're ever in the area, Bretton Hall, Yorkshire Sculpture Park. But the college itself closed down, and I think it's a real loss. I think there's nothing like being forced to spend time with people, having no other options. If you're in a big city, are you going to spend your evenings devising plays that only 20 of your mates are going to see? No, you're probably not. You're probably going to go down the pub and, you know, watch the football or get drunk or whatever. But we didn't do much of that. We ploughed, you know, all our energies and efforts into being creative and doing our own shows and creating our own work. And so glad I went there. I've made some great friends there that I still have today. And now I have very, very fond memories of it.
Yeah, I love the idea of looking across the room. You know, things are weird, and you're catching someone's eye across the room. Because I think, really, especially like creatively, we're all looking for a bit of validation. We're all hoping to find those people that we can connect to and think the same way we do, and then see where that leads in terms of creativity. But as humans, I think we like connecting. So that idea of, especially when things are going like badly and ridiculously like weird, that idea of connection, I think, is really something I related to as you were talking now. I think it's really, really important.
Yes, I mean, for myself, if I think about everything I've done, I've only ever wanted to be part of a team or part of a group. That, to me, gives me the greatest pleasure. I've never needed or wanted to be the star, the single person getting plaudits. I love being part of a creative group, and that goes back to doing plays when you're at school, your first experience of being on a stage. It's about the camaraderie. It's about the excitement of the opening night building up, and suddenly there's makeup and costumes and everyone's getting involved. And I've always loved that excitement. So, and when I think about the shows I've done, you know, I've been very, very lucky to have great ensemble casts. When I went and did Benidorm, we were a great team. We all got on really well. League of Gentlemen, obviously, is that. And when I think of the plays that I've done, I've really enjoyed the camaraderie, meeting those people. It's never been about me, if you see what I mean. So I've tried to keep myself out of it and just enjoy being part of a group. And other people inspire you so much to want to do better work. And so that coming together of myself and Mark and then Reese and then Jeremy, that foursome is still a force to be reckoned with. And I don't think you'll ever break those bonds that we've made. We've never fallen out. We're still great friends. And it's the dream for me. When we were in the middle of doing the League of Gentlemen, I said, if I had to sign a piece of paper now saying I'll only ever work with you lot and we'll only ever do this together, I'll sign it.
That's a wonderful that thing, happened. Isn't it? But it's nice that you can come back. I mean, I saw you guys doing the live show in Brighton, a couple of years ago now. And it was just lovely to see you all working together again and doing the show live. Do you really enjoy that live performance? I mean, doing the league live as well, is something special about that?
Absolutely. I mean, we did start doing live shows. So that's... very different experience going out and doing comedy when an audience doesn't know the characters and doesn't know who you are. So you have to do an awful lot of work to get them on side. It's so different when you're going out in front of two, 3,000 people who only know the characters. They've only come to see you. And that's when you are really reaping the rewards of all the hard work you've put in earlier. But, when we did the first tour of the League of Gentlemen, I think it was after Series 2, so it must have been 2001 or 2. It was almost pre-Twitter and pre-internet, so now you get very instant judgments on things. But then it was, you got reviews, you got a few phone calls, but you didn't really know what it meant to people. And we had our first night in Bristol at the Colston Hall in Bristol, now renamed, I believe. And the second half began with Reese and I emerging as Tubbs and Edward with big angel's wings on. And we came up and we floated above the ruins of the burning local shop. And we were just floating there for minutes and minutes while the audience cheered, clapped. It was like a rock concert. And for the first time, and I turned to look at Reese, and I had tears in my eyes. I was like, I can't believe this reaction. I can't believe what these characters mean to people. Mm. It was so moving. And so having that live connection with the audience was brilliant. And we did miss it, and that's why we did another tour 3 or 4 years ago. And I wouldn't be certain that, I think we'll probably do more live stuff again because it's a real buzz that you can't get anywhere else.
Well, it was lovely seeing new material as well, which I thought was great. Because obviously, I think the first half you were doing quite a lot of the old stuff, Go Johnny, Go, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And then obviously doing some of the league stuff and adding to that as well. And I think that was great as well to see this new material as well, which I think people were really excited about. And like you say, it was palpable in the room almost.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't sure coming back because our audience obviously had aged with us. And you're not sure if you're going to get that youthful reaction. If anything, it was bigger than ever. And it was lovely seeing parents who brought their teenage children along and that we had a whole other generation of fans coming and getting into it. And it was just about celebration. It was a celebration and it was joyful. I didn't really want it to end. We had such a great time and we were doing bigger venues than we'd ever done before. It was amazing, really, when you think what we came from, our first show in Edinburgh, where there were literally three people in the audience, literally, and we had no agent, no promoter. We had photocopied leaflets, which we distributed in the streets ourselves. That whole story, it was amazing to then walk out on the O2 several years later. And the fact that you'd done it with your friends as this group, this tight group, it just meant the world.
Yeah. I my first Edinburgh show I did with my wife, then girlfriend, now wife, and there was three people one night. Two of them were my parents. And the third person was someone that had gone to the wrong show. But out of solidarity, they stayed with us. So, because that would have literally been 33% of the audience going. So thank you to that random person.
I love that. And I think that's really been missed, obviously, this year. Are they going to stage it this year? Obviously, last year it was cancelled. But
they've just announced they're doing something. Yeah, I think they're going to try and stream a lot of stuff. But most comedians I've seen that I follow are saying, we've had a year of no performing, we've got no money whatsoever, and you want us to now pay to go to Edinburgh and put on... I think most are going to miss it, to be honest, and try maybe go next year, but it's been rough. It's been really rough for performers this year.
Horrendous, really horrendous. But, you know, the thing that Edinburgh gives you is, especially if you aren't well-known, I don't know how much... It is getting more and more commercialised, but you could go there totally unknown and 3 weeks and you've turned your whole life around in those 3 weeks. If you manage to arrive with the right show at the right time and the right people get to see you. And that's what happened to us. Like I say, we had... No one knew who we were going in there. We didn't have agents, backers, anything. So it's a really important festival. I think when you get to that middle ground and you're a bit established and you do have people coming, then it can provide a real financial burden on people. I get that. But we'd all chipped in. We had... I think it cost us £2,000 in total. We'd all chipped some money in. But we did everything on the cheap. And we got through on the strength of our material, I think, and the strength of the show. And we collected business cards from people who came to the shows, from different TV and radio companies and different agents. And they would pile up on the kitchen table. And we could start to see that at the end of this 3 weeks, we had options. And it was... absolutely incredible time, 1996.
The Radio 4, the BBC Radio 4 stuff came out the back of doing the Fringe stuff, did it? And doing more and doing the stage plays and stuff.
Yeah, so what happened was we were unsigned. We then met a lot of producers and a lot of agents, and the BBC gave us this deal whereby we would have a Radio 4 series and a BBC 2 series. It was a bi-media deal, and this was just pure faith in us by the likes of John Plowman, Sarah Smith, who was our first producer, Jeffrey Perkins, people like that who, you know, the old school BBC comedy producers who just went to the top brass at BBC, believe in these guys, we must back them and we must give them space creatively to do what they do. And that's the best thing you can have as a new artist. We weren't being told to change stuff up or to that what we did naturally wasn't the right thing. We were just encouraged to do more of what we were doing, and we were given time and space. And so, yeah, we did a Radio 4 series, which was brilliantly instructive. It was going out at 6:30, so it couldn't have a lot of the real dark stuff, but we managed to smuggle in a few things that would have scared the Archer listeners. And then on the back of that, and all that we'd learned from that, we then made a series for BBC Two. But again, it was really cleverly done because we filmed the first episode separately so that we would have time to reflect on what had worked well and what hadn't. Because we didn't know whether to almost mirror what we did with a live show and have a live studio audience and come out and do a more sort of gang show approach, or whether to do the single camera Ken Loachy on location approach, which we'd never had any experience of. All our experience had been doing live shows. And I'll be honest, we were all favouring doing this, you know, get out in front of an audience. You can do your timing. You know how it works. We would have felt more comfortable. But kudos to our producer, Sarah Smith. She said, no, I really want to take you on location. I really want to get you in with a single camera and really create this village, this town. And we had a fantastic director in Steve Bendelack who got all our references. And as soon as we'd done that pilot, we were like, yeah, that's the way to go. Because if you watch the first ever episode, you'll see it is slightly, the local shop scenes and the Denton scenes, they're filmed on sets, and it almost has a sort of 90s sitcom look to it. We had a live studio audience for some of it, and it's very different in tone to the scenes in the job centre with Pauline, which were very Ken Loachy and hyper real.
It's different, isn't it?
It is very different. So in that very first episode, you can see us experimenting with different styles, and in the end, we were delighted with how it turned out. And even though we didn't have a huge budget, they made it look incredible. Everyone working on it made it look absolutely incredible. And that's why when it landed on BBC Two, people were like, what's this? Where's this come from? it's arrived fully formed. We'd never heard of this before. And all the it felt so real to people and palpable to people. And it just took off straight away. It was amazing.
It's amazing. Again, you're talking there about collaboration. You're talking about the producer and the director. Again, that's, you know, that's massive collaboration that's made this thing come to life. And I what I hear as well is massive support. Like you've got support there from people. So I guess that must be so big for your confidence as well at that stage. That these people that believe in you and believe what you do, get your references, like every they're just giving you time and space to create. And I think that's so important when you're a creative person that you've got the support from the people that matter. It must be so big for your confidence at that stage.
Absolutely. I mean, we had not only the support of each other, because we weren't individuals going in. And I think as an individual, I would have crumbled. I would have gone with whatever I was asked to do. But as a team, we had already that you know, mentality of we want to do it our way. And then to have the people around you also be on your wavelength and support you in that way was incredible. We had a period when we were on the recce looking for locations where our producer, assistant producer, kept nipping out to take phone calls. And we believe it was nearly cancelled that, you know, the head of BBC Two at the time just went, why are we spending all this money on this thing, which I don't understand, I don't get it. He'd seen the first episode, he hadn't particularly liked it. And it was very nearly pulled and cancelled, and we were completely unaware. So a lot of stuff was happening behind the scenes. And I think if you are the creative person in the middle of it, you don't want to be thinking about all the business side of things. You don't want to be thinking about what it's costing to build this set or whatever. You just, you know, of course you understand that there are limitations and you have to work within that. But it was the absolute model of how you get the best from people. And we've been very lucky to carry on in the same vein with Psychoville and then Inside Number 9. Working with a lot of the same people, and we feel totally blessed, because I've done other things where I've seen how creativity can get mired down in too many voices, too many conflicting opinions. And yeah, it's been utterly joyful experience for us. And when we tell people about it, they're like, God, I'm so jealous. it's very often hard.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like people get the chance, like you say, to be nurtured and develop what they're doing as much these days, and maybe that's a time and money thing, but I guess there was time and money was still important in those days, but perhaps there was more faith in what you were doing and having those the right, like you say, having the right people around you.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's we were very lucky with the producers that we had, but I think television has moved a little bit, because it used to be, if you go back to the 70s, very writer and director led. Everyone was there to support the vision of the writer or the director. Now it feels more producer-led, and maybe teams of producers, and maybe groups of producers from different companies, and they will be at the top of the pile creatively, and they will hire the director and the writer, and they will try and shape something a bit more. And, you know, you will get some very, very good creative producers. Absolutely, you will. But what frustrates a lot of writers and or directors is that they feel that they're not able to give you their vision, that they feel hampered by for whatever reason. And so I think it's and now with more and more money coming into the industry through the streaming channels, the more money you're spending on something, the more people want to be all over it. And we were honestly left alone. I mean, take Inside Number 9 as an example. We sit in this very room where I'm talking now. We come up with an idea. We write it. We don't tell anyone what we're doing. We send it to our producer. We then cast it, make it. No one from the BBC even reads the scripts. Wow. No one looks at the edits. They leave us alone, and we just give them six finished television programs at the end of it. And now, you know, we have earned that trust, I believe, through the work that we've done. But we don't feel like we're just drowning in notes and other people's thoughts. It's a very pure vision. And like I say, I'm well aware how blessed we are in that regard.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think you'd end up with a very different programme, I think, if there was more more cooks in the kitchen. That's the wrong phrase, but you know where I'm going. That's incredible. But then, obviously, you guys have worked together for such a long time, and you were saying earlier you've never had an argument. But I guess when you've got a group of people working on something, you're always going to have different ideas from stuff. How do you guys work through stuff if you do have slightly different ideas or coming from a different angle? Because I guess that's always going to happen when you're creating in a group.
Yes, of course, that is a process that you have to learn how to do it. So in terms of writing, I don't think we ever tried to be four people in a room writing something. In terms of coming up with an idea for a character and then writing the sketches, we would go into pairs. And we tried different combinations. Sometimes I wrote with Mark, sometimes Reese wrote with Mark. I wrote with Jeremy, but the ones we settled on were me and Reese and Mark and Jeremy. And then it became a question of, okay, well, we've come up with this character. They came up with what they'd done, and we would sit in a room, read them all. And it was a very collegiate atmosphere. It was a very supportive atmosphere. No one was there to be judgmental, but you also have to be aware that, everything has to be good of a certain quality, and you want that quality control. But I don't remember there being really too many difficult conversations, because especially when you're putting those characters on stage in front of an audience, there's no hiding from what's worked and what hasn't.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, it was pretty obvious to all of us when we would try all kinds of stuff. I mean, Jeremy wrote this really funny sketch of this randy rabbi, a very sexualized rabbi, and I, who am not Jewish, said, okay, well, I'll give it a go. And it's full of Hebrew phrases. And well, it was probably my performance, but it pretty much died a death. We did it one night at the Canal Cafe Theatre. And normally, if a sketch had got a few titters, we'd try it again for 2 or 3 weeks. This one, it's like, no, let's forget it. Let's leave the Randy Rabbi for another time. And other things you could see worked instantly. So, you know, that's how we kind of developed stuff, by getting it on its feet in front of people. So we weren't having to say, oh, I don't think that works. It was pretty obvious.
Yeah, let the audience make that decision for you.
Like a gong show, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Jim, it's us again.
It is. We're here again with another special announcement. And this one, Giles, is about a patron that we've launched, because we love our blank community and we want to offer something extra to give back to them.
We do. We do love our community very, very much. And it's lovely interacting with our community on a weekly basis. But we want to just give you a bit more stuff, more blank stuff, because we feel that you might enjoy it.
Yeah, so we're trying to expand our community and expand what we can offer back to you guys for your support. So we're doing what every other podcast in the world is doing. We're starting a Patreon, which means we can offer you guys more content. So our Patreon URL is patreon.com, which is patreon.com/blankpodcast. And there, Giles, is a range of options you can sign up to.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things that people can get from our various different tiers that you can find on there. How many tiers are there altogether, Jim?
Well, there's four tiers in total, and they offer a range of things. For example, you can get ad-free episodes. You can get them 24 hours earlier than the public get them. There's bonus content with our guests that only patrons will get. Giles, there's a 20% code off merchandise.
Oh my goodness, there's even more stuff that you can get that's blank orientated. There's also going to be a very exclusive Facebook group that people can interact with us and one another, and we can talk about all different things, but obviously we can talk about the various guests coming out. We might be able to give you our patrons some special insights into what guests are coming on so that they can pitch some questions themselves.
Exactly. Just another way we're trying to get our listeners really involved in the community and the making of blank. And then in the top tier, there's going to be bonus episodes, Giles.
Yeah, and we're even going to do some director's commentary where we tell you a little bit more about the sort of things that have gone on when we've either gone to record with someone, or the process of recording, the feelings we had on those days, and just give you a little bit more insight into, I guess, what goes into making a podcast.
Indeed. So if all that sounds like the sort of thing you'd like to get on board with, and you'd like to join our ever-expanding Blank community and also help us keep making this podcast, because your support through Patreon will help us keep making Blank, and we would really, really appreciate it, because we love making this podcast and we want to keep doing it forever, essentially. Please do go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/blankpodcast, and sign up to whichever tier takes your fancy.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I know over the years, I mean, we've done an awful lot together as four, and now Rhys and I are working more together. And you do learn to be less precious. Again, it comes down to this thing of it's not about me. It's not about me getting my way or my vision. It's about the end result. And I think we all learned that lesson pretty quickly. We may have had some thorny conversations and some tricky conversations. Of course, that's inevitable. But it's not like in a band where you've got the lead singer, everyone's focused on them, and then everyone's got the resentment to, you know, the guy playing the drums and the bass, think they're not getting their credit. We all were equal in that group. We all came up with great stuff. And so therefore, and things were going well. So I think, you know, people argue when things aren't going quite so well. And if things hadn't worked out for us in Edinburgh, maybe we would have had a few more arguments. I don't know, but you know, we just enjoyed each other's company, and I'm not trying to make it sound like it was the Brady Bunch. We definitely had some tricky conversations, but you know, the end, the whole is bigger than the sum of its parts. Is that the phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and Jeremy said as well, I remember him, and Jeremy's very wise, as you will find out when you talk to him. And he said, you know, you don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs in order to run away with one golden egg. You keep that goose alive. Therefore, you feed the thing that is giving us all this amazing creative output. And we saw that was the more important thing. So egos were out the window, and we made, you know, we just got there. And the fact that we're still friends, we still talk to each other, and we've been working together 30 years, I think that's, you know, whatever we did, it worked.
Going back to Inside Number 9, obviously we're talking about, you've obviously earned the right to be trusted with television shows, and you know, your writing is obviously well-trusted as well. But when you sort of pitched that idea of an anthology series, I mean, you know, obviously in recent years, you know, back in the day, like 70s, we had things like Tales of the Unexpected. Like Inside Number 9 is kind of in a similar ilk, obviously more comedy-led. Anthology series have only recently started to sort of resurface. We've obviously seen resurgence with things like Black Mirror, and obviously what you guys are doing probably came out kind of similar sort of time. Was that a difficult pitch, though? Was it difficult to get people on board with that because of the idea of an anthology? People like, you know, I know this because I'm, you know, I do writing. Like within writing, people don't want one-offs sometimes, they want series. So was that a tricky pitch?
It was, in a way, because we'd heard that would be the reaction. So you kind of go in a bit guardedly. And I suppose where we were very lucky is that we had a meeting with the controller of BBC Two. So you were going in right at the very top for your meeting. You weren't having to take it through several channels. And Janice Hadlow was her name, and she was a huge fan of Saki short stories. So she understood the form. There's something very, very beautiful about a perfectly formed miniature, whether it be art or short stories or an anthology piece of television, a beginning, middle and end in one sitting. It can be very satisfying. So she completely got it, because she was the head decision maker. They decided to commission a couple of scripts from us. And we couldn't even sell it. We couldn't even say this is the tone, because we didn't want to settle on it's going to be all science fiction or all horror. We didn't know what it was going to be. And this is another thing about, I mean, you know, at the moment we're trying to talk about developing new shows and people want to see pitch documents. We've never written a pitch document in our lives because what you want to do is create the thing itself,
yeah.
not a description of what it might be once you've been working on it for a month or so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we were very, very fortunate. Once again, we were told to go away and write two self-contained stories, and that's what we did. And then once they'd read them and enjoyed the scripts, then the commission was quite straightforward. If we'd done a couple of duff ones, then maybe. But we weren't even thinking, oh, it's got to have a twist ending every time. In fact, one of them didn't. The first one we wrote, it ended up being an episode called Nana's Party. It was a very suburban, yeah. We didn't do it in the first series in the end because it was very lighthearted and sitcom-y. And the other one we wrote was Tom and Jerry, which was very dark and did have this incredibly dark ending. And they loved that combination of those two scripts and how they complemented each other. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the more we get, we are in a golden age. I know people keep saying that, but there are box sets you can lose yourself in. They talk about the novelization of television. But for me, there's nothing quite so satisfying as seeing a story in its, you know, in one sitting, having no idea where it's going to go and having a great ending. And the ending, if you get it right, can send a ripple back across the rest of the story that makes you want to immediately go and watch it again. So it's, you know, it's something that we've become, I think, quite versed in now, how to do that. I love reading short stories as well. I mean, I read Mark Haddon's short story collection, The Pier Falls, which I would highly recommend. Absolutely brilliant, breathtaking stories. Each one very, very different. And also Hubert Selby Jr., Song of the Silent Snow. So I was a big fan of short stories and Jeremy's short stories as well. So, yeah, we decided to go against the grain. The idea at the time was that you wanted to create multi-episode narratives. And in a way, we'd done that with Psychoville. We'd done something that was a big ongoing narrative. So I suppose we've just never done what's been obvious, and that's kept us in some way relevant. I described it as looking back to look forward. We were looking back to play for today. We were looking back to Tales of the Unexpected and going, why isn't there something like that on now? You know, they're plays. They're plays. They are single set plays that you could put on a stage, and we hope to one day. And that's what gave them, you know, it's different. We're used to a lot of very fast-cutting, fast-paced television where, you know, you don't go 3 seconds without a cut. And it was nice just to sit with some great actors in a wardrobe or wherever they were going to be and just watch them tell this story. It, as soon as we saw what we got, we thought, yeah, this, it feels special.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, I loved watching Twilight Zone and Tales from the Crypt, all those kind of things as well. Those, you know, those one-off stories were just, I always really enjoyed it, and Tales from the Unexpected as well, which, you know, is probably too young to be watching those kind of programs, but I loved watching Tales of the Unexpected. And yeah, and like you say, I think we were, as an audience, we're kind of ripe for those kind of things now. Like you say, we're so, everything's so immediate and instant gratification and all that kind of stuff. But I think there's something to be said for those short stories. You know, I think in literature as well, not enough people read short stories, I don't think. And there's something to be said for them. They're, you know, they can be very beautiful. And I think, you know, with what you've done with the series as well, there's out and out comedy episodes, but, you know, there's lots of drama, there's thrillers, there's, you know, dark horror. You know, you've kind of entered into each genre as well with it, which is fascinating, and I think that's what probably brings people back every season, because they want to see what you're going to do next, I think.
Well, you know, I mean, I remember, because I'm from a background, you know, I'm from Chorley in Lancashire. I've got no one in my family who's ever been interested in theatre. We never went to theatre, we never saw plays, but I really remember the excitement of going to the playgroup, and there would be a box of dressing up clothes and hats. And I just, from the earliest age, I remember being fascinated by all these different possibilities, all these different characters that you could be just by looking in the dressing up box. I loved that. I loved making up stories. And in a way, that's still what I'm doing. I'm going to the dressing up box every week and opening it up and going, what's in here? What characters can we find? What different hats can we put on? So it really stayed with me, that notion of the possibilities of you know, there's no one way to tell a story. And that's something we've explored in Inside Number 9. How you tell the story is as important as what the story is. But also going back to hats, I mean, Bretton Hall, the audition for Bretton Hall, and your wife might remember this, Jim. Did she do drama, by the way, or did she do a different subject?
Yeah. I can't remember what the course was. It was acting or something like that.
Well, they would have these sort of sessions, your audition for to get in there. They would have a box of hats at one end of the room. And they would say, OK, everyone go and get a hat. Well, there was this sprint for these hats. Everyone was sort of pulling and trying to get the best hats. But you had to come up with a character. And I kind of thought, you know what? Whatever it is, I'll make it work. Whatever the hat is, whatever's left. So I kind of nonchalantly strolled up. I can't even remember what I had now, but it was just that belief I had that there's a story in everything. It doesn't have to be the most ostentatious hat that's going to give you the best character and the best story. It can be anything at all. It can be, you know, a piece of newspaper that you fold up and put on, or a knotted handkerchief. Anything can give you a story. And but yeah, it was just a very funny image, and obviously we managed to come through it and do the right thing, myself, Mark, and Reese.
So you've always had that confidence, that self confidence in your sort of performing ability then. And where did that come from? If there was no one in your family that had a sort of history or you know, love of the theatre.
Well, maybe I used the word confidence a bit too easily there, because I was quite shy, and I wasn't one of these, you know, my idea of a drama student was the opposite of what I was, which was a very normal pullover and jeans, unremarkable kind of guy. But I came alive on stage. That was what people thought of me. I wasn't someone who in real life was the life and soul of the party. So I wasn't confident as a person. And I suppose there's still elements of that, that you find yourself through your work being able to do things that you didn't think you were able to. I think it was just a love of storytelling. I loved English. I loved writing. Making up poems. And I was quite solitary, I suppose, as a child, in that I was very at ease with my own company, because I knew that if, you know, myself and my own imagination was enough for me. I could sit on my own in my room. I didn't need to be going out with big gangs of kids. And, you know, I remember going out with my brother and some friends, and they would play knock a door run, knocking on someone's door, running away. That's what we had for entertainment back in the day. I don't know if kids, do kids still do that now?
We heard you delve into what we're guessing is probably the greatest anecdote we've never heard on the podcast. You said about me and my brother, and then you went, and it was like the little teaser before the anecdote, and then we never got it. But that's where we lost you.
But no, what I was saying, talking about confidence, and you know, me and my brothers and his friends, we used to go out playing knock a door run. And I was saying, I don't know if people do that anymore. I don't know if kids even go out anymore, but used to go to random people's doors, knock on the door and run away. And what I was saying was, I would do this. I would go out in the evenings and I would think, why am I doing this? Why am I wasting my time doing this? I'd much rather be at home reading, making something, drawing something, making little paper models. Or I always just was drawn to doing that creative thing rather than what was typical of... Because especially from the north, there's a real... bravado, there's a real banter, there's a real kind of and I love it. I love all that stuff, but it's just not me. So I just felt very different to a lot of stuff that was happening, you know, with my brother and his mates. And then I just got into drama at school. You know, there wasn't many boys doing it. It was a great way of meeting girls, as a lot of people say. And there were two boys, and whole room full of girls, and we would do plays at Christmas, and I just came alive. I just loved being on stage. And I'll tell you, the first time I was on stage, we did a Christmas Carol, and I was playing Fezziwig, who's Scrooge's boss.
My brother played Fezziwig in a local production of it. I think the church had a production of it on.
Well, it's a small part, but you can make your mark. So what had happened, so he only has a couple of scenes right at the beginning when he's telling Scrooge, as a young man, he's saying, go home, have fun at Christmas. And I just had this one moment where I sort of hit my head and went, oh, I forgot, it's Christmas Eve. Now, the day came to do the show and all the makeup people came. And in order to make me look older, they put a load of talcum powder in my hair. It wasn't as grey like I am now. And so when I hit my head and went, oh, I almost forgot. And I hit my head with my palm of my hand. And this plume of talcum powder rose. And I got the biggest laugh, which I didn't know where it was coming from. But I just stood there. The audience were in hysterics. And I thought, wow, I love this. Look at that audience. And of course, the next night, I did it twice as hard and really tried to make it happen. Didn't get a thing. Didn't get a laugh at all. So... it was a great learning experience, but it just gave me that bug. And then I would do amateur theatre or anything. But I was known as being quite shy and softly spoken. And, you know, I remember being at, at Bretton Hall. And when there's a lot of big characters who do drama, and it can be very intimidating. And they seem to talk in a way that you don't. They seem to have their own language almost, and it can be quite... this is why a lot of people have an image of actors as being lovies, you know. So there was a group of students in a room all talking, and it was the first week and I didn't really know anybody. And I went into this room because the door was half open, and people kind of almost sort of acknowledged me and nodded, but no one actually spoke to me. And I stood there for about 10 minutes trying to get into this conversation. I couldn't think of anything to say to anybody. And then I just sort of nodded and I walked back out again and went back to my room. And I just thought, oh, God, I can't do this. I can't just come in and have this instant banter with people, you know. So it was very excruciating. For me, it takes time to get to know people and time to make those connections and those bonds. So that's why when I had this thing with Mark and our eyes locked across the room, he was also like that. He was like me. And we weren't the big characters. So, but, you know, I think I'm doing now what I love. I can still be quite awkward in social situations, but I've got better at it. And I was unwavering in my desire to carry on doing the performance, the creativity. And even when, because I was quite bright, I could have done other subjects at school, at university. I just said to my dad, please let me do the drama, please, you know. And he relented, and he was, you know, I mean, sadly, my dad died in 1998. And so that was just before League of Gentlemen got onto TV. But I was able to ring him when we won the Perrier Award in 1997. They used to do it at midnight after all the shows had finished. And I've never heard him so proud. He was beside himself with happiness. And I'm really glad I got to have that moment so I could go, you know what, Dad, of course I went to Bretton Hall. And then I had about 10 years on the dole where I seemed to be doing nothing at all. Going to Edinburgh, I would say, it's not a question of what we make, it's a question of what we lose. He could not comprehend any of this kind of stuff. But so to be able to go and say, Dad, we won. We won this. You know, we won Edinburgh. It meant a huge amount, and then he got to hear the Radio 4 series. But sadly, none of the rest of it he's been aware of. But my mum loves it. She's my biggest fan now.
That's really lovely. I think in a way, we're all trying to sort of make people proud, I think, with the things we do, especially if it's something that maybe they're not particularly into or aware of. I think we're all trying to make someone proud or show what we can do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's definitely, you know, it was, there was a sort of incomprehension about what I was doing. And my brothers were into business. And now my brothers and I've got two younger brothers. We get on like a house on fire. We all go away on holiday together. But for a period in our teenage years, we had nothing in common whatsoever. And after these sort of abortive attempts to go out playing pranks, and I realized that wasn't me. And he went into business and, you know, he set up his own business. I went to do drama and we had nothing to talk about. So we had some pretty awkward years between the ages of sort of 18 and 22, 23. And then I remember coming back home to Chorley and having conversations with him about what he'd been up to. And we would just, and I would tell him what I'd been up to, and we just reconnected again. And we've been very, very close ever since. But it can be hard, that feeling that no one gets me in my family. And they don't get why it's so important that I watch Alan Bennett's Talking Heads and that no one comes into the room when it's on, because it is, you can't just talk over it. No one got that, you know? You can feel like on your own and isolated, and then it's making those connections. And for me, it was going to Bretton and making those connections. And like I said earlier, that's been the making of all of us, I think.
Yeah, you're talking to two guys here who were shy kids as well. Like, and so we get it. And I think there is definitely, you're not, the world wants you to grow up and be this uber confident person, but a lot of us aren't. You know, Reese came on the podcast and he talked a lot about social anxiety and feeling awkward in social experiences. And I think a lot of people still do. But when you sort of know that you are, okay, this is me. I'm not the life and soul of the party. I'm a bit of a shy, awkward person. And that's okay. When you're true to yourself like that, you will then gravitate towards other people that are like you. You will find them. And then you find your tribe. And then you find your tribe that are like you, and you're being yourself. So it is difficult. It is really hard to be yourself when you're not a massively confident person, you're a bit shy. But in the end, you do find your tribe.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a whole world of people out there. So, you know, I think going to different places, doing different jobs. I mean, that's why I guess you're very blessed in this profession, is that, you know, you are able to constantly meet new people. And constantly find those connections, because every job takes you to a different place or to a different group. And so you get over those difficulties you found as a teenager. And but yeah, like I say, for me, it was I've always loved that being part of a group thing. And I think that's because I came from feeling quite isolated and shy. That's why I find solace in being part of a team. In everything I do.
Jim, it's us again. And we've got some big news.
We have indeed. Giles, I can't believe I'm saying this. We've written a book about blank moments based on this very podcast.
Yeah, we've been recording this podcast for a while now. And as we've been doing, we've realised that everyone has these difficult blank moments. All our wonderful guests that we have on the podcast and our listeners get in touch with us all the time to tell us about their own situations, their own experiences of blank moments. And sometimes that can be from a personal life, from their career, the relationships they're in, or maybe it's a public situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those terms that can be applied to anything. Social anxiety, imposter syndrome, just sort of generally being off form, having an identity crisis. I mean, it's all part of the human condition, and yet we all get thrown off from time to time and sort of made to feel a bit helpless.
Yeah, so the book is made up of all these different chapters that sort of concentrate on these various themes that come up in the pod. So whether it's public failure, social anxiety, fear, mental health, grief, all the things that our amazing guests have talked about on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, and those guests include Louis Theroux, David Harbour, Reggie Hunter, Dawn French, Rachel Paris, Amanda Abington, John Ronson, Rufus Sewell, Gary Lineker, all these people that really opened up to us about these difficult moments. And what we've done is we've dived into them, explained how we relate to them, talked a little bit about our own experiences, and almost gone on a journey of this discovering blank moments and how they've helped us. And we hopefully take the reader on a journey with us.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff in there for everybody, I think. It's a bit memoir, it's a bit self-help, and there's lots of interactive bits in there as well, so you can do your own gratitude list, and there's tips on if you're having sleeping problems. So all different things that you can take out of the book. And where can people get hold of this book, Jim?
Well, so it comes out in March in 2021, but it's available to pre-order right now from Amazon, waterstones.com and hive.co.uk.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to everyone getting their hands on it. And hopefully lots of people will be able to identify their own blank moments. And you never know what you might find out.
And have you ever wanted to do anything on your own? Have you ever wanted to do anything solo or had that urge to sort of do your own thing?
Well, there's not a lot of stuff you can do solo, in our profession. But someone's trying the door. I have written things on my own. I have written without Reason and Mark and Jeremy, and you know that's. Sorry, I'll just let them go. Because, so in answer to your question, I have written on my own, and I find it harder to. You don't get the instant sort of acknowledgement of what you've done is right or not. I mean, there's no such thing as right and wrong in writing anyway. There's just variations of what you go with. But I missed that companionship and I missed that other person in the room. So I would still do it. In fact, I've just written something on my own. It happens more, not through choice. It happens through Reese being selfish and getting another job. And that's when I go, well, I'm not going to just sit and wait. I'll come up with something on my own. And a few episodes of Inside Number 9 have happened like that, especially if it's been something I've been more interested in, like cryptic crosswords or football. I just think, well, there's no point... trying to educate Reese immediately into all of this stuff. I'll just write it and we'll then work on it together. And it's very useful to get his opinion as someone who's not an expert on those things. But when it comes to like my own acting work, I don't have any kind of plan. I never had a master plan. I've never said to my agent, get me in a drama. I want to do a period thing on BBC One. I just go with what comes up. And I think in that way, and there are periods of time when it's not going your way and you're not working very much. And there's periods of time when you might have three things on the trot. And I've learned very much it's like this, it's like the ocean, you know. It comes in, it goes out. But if you have that sort of, you know, my phrase is it's a marathon, not a sprint. And if you're in it for the long haul and you can take those ebbs and flows, then... You know, no matter how desperate you might feel, something will happen, something will come up, and it always does. And no matter what stage I was at in my career, whether it was doing fringe work for no money or now where I've got lots of options, stuff does always happen. And it's having that resilience, which has been especially hard the past year, right? I mean, when it seems so bleak and people couldn't work. I mean, we were very lucky. We could write, but performers, musicians, comedians, actors, people could not work. They couldn't do what they wanted to do. They could not make money for themselves. I found it really, really troubling. And I, you know, you do what you can in those situations. But resilience has been the byword of you just say to people, hold on, try to get through it and, you know, see the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's hopefully what we're seeing now is, I don't know about live performance, when that will come back in again. But, it's been incredibly hard. There's no other way of saying it.
And you've been, I mean, obviously you filmed the latest series of Inside Number 9 during lockdown. Was that difficult logistically to do, was it, or were you able to adapt quite quickly?
Yes, well, I mean, we started filming in March last year, March 2020, and we got 3 days in to one of the episodes, and there was this sort of quite feverish atmosphere where people were talking. I mean, you'll remember what it was like in March last year.
Yeah.
And very quickly it became obvious we couldn't carry on, so... We stored it and We waited, and in the meantime, Rhys and I, because we knew we had a further series commissioned, we started to write. When we picked it up again was November last year, November 2020. And life finds a way. We had testing done. We had masks on where possible. All the crew had masks on all day. They really suffered. We, of course, were able to take them off and do our thing. And we went on to sets rather than into real people's houses, so that on a studio, you've got a lot more space, a lot more air circulating. I hate this phrase, the new normal. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be the new normal. Yeah. And I hate bumping elbows with people. I can't stand it. But you've got to do what you've got to do. We really wanted to make this program, and we got it done by hook or by crook. And a few hairy moments, a few times we would come back after lunch and they'd say, oh, the cameraman's gone. He's gone. He's not coming back for 2 weeks. Positive test. And then everyone in his bubble, so every department had their own bubble, they had to go as well.
Wow.
And you would get, and then you'd have to pause for 2 or 3 hours while replacements were sought. One day that happened with the caterers, so we had a very sticky lunchtime with 80 members of crew standing in a car park waiting for one man on his moped to deliver pizzas, three at a time. That was quite fun. We got it done, and it's going to be, well, I don't know when you're putting your podcast out, but yeah, we got Series 6 done and Series 7 being prepped now, so.
Yeah, it's, oh, sorry, Giles, you used the word resilient there, and that is, I think that's, I mean, you're just talking about that you have to be resilient through these weird times. We have to be, as creators, resilient anyway. I think that's something that, as creative people, we often maybe don't even realise how resilient we are, to be honest. I think it is something that's in us that keeps us going, that maybe you don't even know how resilient you are, but you have to be to keep going in any creative industry. And I think a lot of people listening to this podcast, I know, creative people as well, and I think, you know, if you are a creative person and you're doing your thing, then you are resilient.
Absolutely you are. Because, you know, you're entering into the unknown. And when each job, I mean, you know, when each job finishes, you're back in the unknown again. And so you do build up those defences. And I think you do get better that, you know, it might seem harder when you're in your 20s, when you're starting out. You do build that muscle up, for want of a better word. You do get more resilience, and you do find yourself able to cope with things once you've been through them once or twice. Then you know a little bit about what you're doing, and don't give up and try and make things happen for yourself. There's always something proactive you can do.
There always is,
you know. You are never helpless. There's always stuff you can do, people you can contact, or stuff you can do on your own to put yourself in a better position. I'm saying all of this. It's very hard when you're in the middle of it. It's very difficult when you feel a bit helpless. I mean, there's been times when, you know, when we left Bretton Hall, we didn't immediately start doing The League of Gentlemen. You know, there were times when, you know, I moved to London thinking I was going to get work as an actor, and I was going for auditions for children's touring theatre companies and not getting any of the jobs. And you can't see where, you know, if a break is going to come. And to be honest, I was never into it for that. I was never into it for the big break or the big bucks. I just wanted to do the thing. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to be part of that group doing that thing. And that's why I set up a theatre company, a non-profit theatre company. And everything came from that. So, you know, there were times when I felt nothing was going to happen. But it didn't matter as much because I was doing what I loved. But I knew there would be a limit on that in terms of my bank balance.
Unfortunately, yeah, there is. Money is needed. I have to ask as well, you just mentioned football there. Who's your football team?
Blackburn Rovers.
Ah, yeah, I like Blackburn Rovers.
Yeah, I was born in Blackburn. Born in Blackburn, grew up in Chorley. So I used to have my cousin's boyfriend used to take me to watch them at Ewood Park. Ewood Park, I don't know if you've ever been, but it's got big grass banks all around. So people would often go and just sit and not pay to get in. But yeah, and we had a very exciting season, 94-95, when of course we won the Premier League. And
yes,
it's been slightly downhill since then, but I always have followed them. And
my favorite ever Crystal Palace player, Matt Janssen, also played for Blackburn and until recently was the manager of
Shoreditch. That's right, yeah. Oh, is he? Oh, I didn't know that.
I think he left. But he was. I went to interview him for Palace TV while he was manager of Chorley 3 or 4 years ago. Very nice guy. Really nice guy.
And didn't he have a really debilitating accident where he had a very bad brain injury and he came back from that and played again? So, yeah, there again, resilience. And Chorley have had a great run in the FA Cup this year. It was amazing to see them see those scenes of them celebrating, and I really wanted them to go to the next round. But I love going back. I mean, I don't go back so often. There's five of us now in my family, so it's very hard to go back and for us all to stay, to descend on my mum's house and all stay. So my mum comes to see me in London. But whenever I do go back, I get very, very nostalgic. And, you know, those things as a kid that seemed so big, and those journeys you used to take between one village and another that felt like an adventure, you realise you can do in 3 minutes. And I love going back and retracing the stuff I did as a kid. And so, it'll always be a part of me that's very glad to have come from there. And I think it does keep you grounded. And all that stuff about bloody London, London prices you pay down there. I love all of that.
It's true.
I love all of that. Yes, of course it is true, yes.
Well, I do want to ask you one more question before we do that. When you're writing in the room together, do you flesh out scenes? Are you performing them, or have you written scripts and then you kind of come together and you're?
We don't perform them. We don't as such. But you do, once you've done your day's work or half day's work, you will read it back just to see how it flows, and it's very useful. That, you know, we are two actor writers, so that we know we can tell, just, you know, it's very much about the written word, but then we make sure we do a reading and you can just hear it. You get an ear for what flows, what works, whether you've over explained something or whether there's too much dialogue. So that's what we do. And by the end, we rewrite as we're going along and we'll just send it to our producer and see if he's got any comments. But, you know, we've been doing it 30 years now, Reese and I, and we've got pretty good at it. So even when we were working on Zoom, which is, you know, pretty... I'm sure you guys would much rather be doing what you do in a room together with someone. It's very... Especially when the bloody Wi-Fi keeps cutting out. It's very, very difficult. But we've got that shorthand now, and so Reese and I just... We get on with it. We don't overthink it. But, yeah, we do mini... readings at the end of every day.
That's great. Well, I have to say, before we wrap up, the football episode is one of my favourite.
Yes.
It's such a fantastic episode. So I'm glad that you were able to get your love of football into one of the Inside Number Nines. It's a real treat, that episode.
Yeah, it was great, yeah. The referees are W...
Yeah.
A double meaning when you watch it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favourites, I have to say. And David Morrissey's fantastic.
Always good value.
Well, Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And, can't wait for the new series to come out, because I'm a huge fan. And
well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. And I should explain to the listeners that I hightailed it to my very dodgy Wi-Fi office because I had builders and gardeners come in to where the house either side of my house. So it was so noisy. But I apologise if there's been any disturbance in your enjoyment.
We made it work.
I'm sure the editing... Will be...
We were resilient. We were resilient. Yeah. We made it work.
Very, very good. Very good. Okay. Well,
thank you very much.
Hope to see you in the flesh one day.
You too.
Absolutely.
You. Go.
Steve Pemberton. What a legend. What a really, really nice guy. And I was thinking, actually, as we were chatting to him, I was thinking, I bet he's been asked a lot of questions about The Gentleman, Inside Number 9 over the years. And yet he spoke with such passion. It was almost like it was the first time he'd not been asked about them. I thought he was such a pro in that regard. Mm. Really spoke with such sort of, you can feel the love and the warmth. And we had it with Mark and Reese as well. Mm. You can tell the love they have for each other and the warmth they have for these memories of looking back. Like, it's just such a, it's so lovely to hear them talk about those memories. And lots of great stuff from Steve about, you know, writing and working as part of a team and, you know, Inside Number 9, new season's out now. So it's interesting to hear him talking about that before it was coming out. You know, we're lucky to get the insight from these guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what they do.
Yeah, yeah. It was, it's so great to just chat with Steve and hear about all the different sort of aspects of his work and that, like you say, that relationship with those guys and the joy they have of working together. And that's just wonderful, isn't it? And
yeah,
I know from doing this podcast with you, Jim, what it's like to sort of find a comrade, and it's yeah, lovely, you know, when you do that and you find that. And I've had that with, you know, playing in bands with people. That camaraderie and collaboration is wonderful when you meet those sort of people, and it is very serendipitous a lot of the time. You know, you don't, you know, it's very hard to sort of seek those people out. It does sort of come and happen by chance a lot of the time.
Yeah, it does. It's just interesting sort of, I mean, this comes up on the pod quite a lot, but like sort of knowing who you are and what works for you, and sort of Steve talking about that being part of a team and collaborating is his thing and he feels happiest doing it. And I think we all sometimes creatively are looking for what is our thing, where do we fit in? But when you found it, and he talks about feeling very lucky, you know, when you found what works for you, and we're all sort of pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, aren't we? Trying to sort of slot into where we work. And then when you do it, you know, wonderful things can happen, as they have for Steve and the boys. Mm. So, yeah, I really get a sense of appreciation and love from those guys for what they do and for each other. And it's just really, it's really heartwarming.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it, like, you know, we say it's a lot, like, it's important to have that gratitude and be able to purvey that in some way. And, you know, that comes across in, you know, it really does come across with a lot of what Steve was saying, that gratitude for being able to do the things that they've been able to do and to continue to be able to do. And that's a really important thing, I think, as creative people, is when you get opportunities to do, you know, to work on projects and things in life that you wouldn't necessarily thought would happen to you, and to be grateful for those moments. And as you would say, Jim, give yourself the win.
On my catchphrase, isn't it? We need to get that on a t-shirt, actually.
We do, yeah.
Yeah, no, and we're grateful to Steve as well for giving up his time and chatting to us. We do really, really appreciate it. It was lovely to connect to him. So thank you very much to Steve. Quick thank you to our patrons. Our patron has launched. We've got a few people are joining. So thank you very much. And our first patron episode with the bonus content will be out very soon, next week, I think.
Yes. I'm not going to reveal who it is, because that's for another time. But yes, we have got some really, I'm going to tell you what, Jim, we've got some really exciting guests coming up. And actually, I'm really excited about the extra content. I'm not just saying that to get people to sign up. There was some great little extras that we've had along the way. So please, if you enjoy the podcast and you want a little bit more, you know, we're giving you a little bit more.
Yeah, I get really excited when we sort of stop the normal recording and do the patron extra question. I get quite nervous and excited.
Yeah,
this new thing we're doing, we're giving our patrons a bit more. So if you want to hear a bit extra from our guests each week, then please do sign up to our Patreon. It's Patreon, Patreon, .com/blank podcast. And we'd love to have you on board. And that starts next week. Oh, yeah. I'm so excited. And obviously Inside Number 9, new series out now. So make sure you do go and check that out.
Yeah, definitely. It's brilliant, brilliant show. Go back and watch all the others if you haven't ever watched it before. And you can dip in and out early as well. It's not, you know, because it's an anthology series. So you can, you know, pick and choose the ones you want to watch. But it is incredible. I don't think there's a bad episode. I don't think there's a bad episode. It's all incredibly great. And for whatever you're into, you'll find something that you'll like. So definitely check it out. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and our handles are, Jim.
Oh, I never get to do this bit. It's exciting. At Blank Pod.
Yeah, and you can also email us. We have an email. I don't know if people know about what that is, but
we never get any, so clearly not. Yeah. But if you do want to send an email, it's theblankpodcast2018@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Oh, can I do one more promo thing as well? My live show, which is in June, hopefully can go ahead. I'm sure it will. It'll be distanced, socially distanced, I think. We're recording this top and tail a few weeks before this episode goes out. There's currently 10 tickets left for the second show. So I'm doing 23rd.
So by the time this goes out, they'll be sold out then.
Might be sold out. I don't know. Ticket sales sort
too
of
late. Unfortunately, sorry about that, guys. You should have got in quicker.
Yeah. Well, there's still quite a few left for the first night. So 23rd of June and 24th of June down at the Caxton Arms in Brixton during Brighton Fringe. If you want to get a ticket, be quick. Although who knows what's available by the time this goes out. Go to jimdailycomedy.com/gigs. Would love to see you. It's going to be a fun night or two nights.
I'm looking forward to it.
And thus ends my promo.
I haven't got anything to promote, really, other than I've got a book out.
Oh, we've got a book out.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. We've got so much to cram
in. Sure we've probably put that in the pod anyway. So sorry about that. Extra.
Probably.
We've got merch. We've got books. We've got a Patreon. So, you know, sorry. But, you know, we need to live. So I need to eat this week.
People have been really supportive, actually. The book stuff's going so well. People are just being so nice about it and leaving us lovely reviews. So thank you. If you've bought a copy, thank you. If you've left a review, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate the support.
Really. We do. No, we honestly do. And it's we love our blank community. So thanks, everybody, for all your constant support and lovely messages.
Indeed. Right, that's it. Thank you to Steve. Thank you, Giles. Thank you, patrons. Thank you, listeners. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Blank Podcast. Have a great week. Stay safe. And we'll see you again very soon.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.